Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Eric Bork. We're doing something a little different for the show today. Instead of doing a live show with guests in the studio ready to take your calls, we're going to hear from Guy Raz, host and editor of the TED Radio Hour. Guy Raz came up to visit Alaska in August of 2016 and spoke to an audience at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. It was a great event, and we're very happy to be playing it for you here today. If you enjoy this sort of programming and great events like this one was, we encourage you to become a member of Alaska Public Media today by calling 550-8484 or by visiting alaskapublic.org. And we thank you. Here's Guy Raz.
Thank you. I hope I look like the NPR nerd you imagined. Yeah. You know, a lot of people, when they meet me, they'll say, you look nothing like what I thought. And I always don't know how to answer that because it's always a little bit awkward. But I hope I look a little bit like what you thought, or maybe not too disappointing. Yeah, it's amazing to see so many people here. I live in Washington, D.C., and I ride my bike to work every day and ride it home. And I have this amazing team that I work with, and we work in a little black box. You know, it's a radio studio where we create this show every week. And so we don't often get to meet the people who listen to the show, you know, because I work at NPR and everybody's sort of doing their own thing. And to see so many people come out to support Alaska Public Media and the TED Radio Hour is just so incredible. Thank you for being here. It's actually been an incredible few days here in Alaska. I've been here for 2 days, and in those 2 days, I've seen a moose, I've seen 7 glaciers, and I have seen a guy pick berries with this claw-like contraption that endlessly fascinated me. He had these giant buckets of berries. I'm visiting here with my wife and my 2 small children, and they couldn't be here tonight. I asked my 5-year-old if he'd like to come see Daddy speak tonight, and he looked at me and he said, Daddy, that sounds really boring. So if it proves to be prescient, my wife and children are at the Glacier Pub in downtown Anchorage. And so in the middle of this, if you want to join them, they're there watching the Olympics. And I've eaten so much salmon here. I was talking about this the other night to some people. I've eaten salmon at like every meal. I've had salmon burgers and salmon steaks and salmon jerky and salmon candy and, you know, salmon, like, whatever, you know, everything. I mean, I feel like I've eaten so much salmon that you could just get your daily omega-3s by shaking my hand. I'm so, like, salmoned out. So, and, I mean, you guys hoard the salmon. You know, in the Atlantic coast, we get this pink, like, colored, farmed, flavorless salmon. So I'm feeling like there's like a salmon conspiracy in Alaska. But it's just incredible to be here. A few weeks before I got here, I started to get some emails from people out of the blue, random emails from people saying, hey, I hear you're coming to Anchorage, and I'd love to show you around. And so I decided to take one of these strangers up on the offer. And we landed a couple days ago, and I said to my wife, yeah, so this guy is going to meet us and take us somewhere. And she said, is that safe? And I said, I think so. And it indeed it was. It was great. I think they may be in the audience somewhere. And we went to on a hike and saw, you know, these just beautiful grand vistas of Anchorage from the mountains and these craggy peaks and the blueberry aforementioned berry pickers. And I strained to see it, but I was not able to see Russia. So I will report back to Washington when I get to Washington, D.C. So TED. Every year I go to the main TED conference. It's in Vancouver. And this really peculiar thing about the TED conference, which is that there is a direct correlation between dress and wealth. And so the shabbier you dress, the richer you are. So if you see like a guy who's unshaven, wearing ripped jeans, and like the kind of sandals or flip-flops you would wear in the shower at the gym, you know, like the dude in the Big Lebowski, he's a billionaire every time. And it's really weird because every time I speak to a group and I see like well-dressed people, I just think they must be really poor. It's completely changed my perspective. Anyway, so Ted, I'm less often now, but sometimes asked if I am Ted, or if there is somebody named Ted, or if that person's last name is Tox. And as you all know, the answer is no. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, and it was founded in 1984 as this was a geeky little conference of academics and computer geeks and scientists, and they would talk about their kind of cool things that they came up with. This actually was the introduction of the compact of the CD-ROM. It was the first time the CD-ROM was unveiled in 1984 on the TED stage. And around 2000, it changed into a different organization, an organization that really became dedicated to spreading ideas around the world. And so today, if you visit TED's website, TED.com, you can find thousands, and I'm sure many of you have explored it, you can find thousands of amazing talks on all kinds of topics, not just technology, entertainment, and design, but you can actually find topics on things like ducks who are necrophiliacs. It was a real talk. I saw it. It was shocking. There are talks on the science of aging. This is from Cynthia Kenyon, an amazing researcher who's actually increased the lifespan of these worms, these C. elegans, by like 700%. She's been on our show. She's amazing. I mean, she believes that science will eventually tackle the problem or the challenges of aging and even reverse it. So the story goes like this. About 3 years ago, TED approached NPR and they said, how can we collaborate on a show? And I was brought on to create that show. And today, we're lucky enough to have become one of the five most listened to NPR produced programs in the country. It's just been an amazing journey. Thank you. We're now reaching 8 million people around the world every week through our radio shows and our podcast. And it's just been an incredible 3 years. This is the team that produces the show. It's five of us, and we love what we do. And what we do is, a lot of beards up there. We take a theme, right? And we find TED Talks to organize around that theme. And then the idea is that, a theme like love or happiness or discovery, and the idea is how can we recreate the magic of seeing a TED Talk live and in person, but on the radio? And that's the challenge. And when people ask me, what's the show about? I tell them that it's pretty simple. The TED Radio Hour is a show about what it means to be human. Now, working on a show about big human-scale ideas isn't what I always did. In fact, for most of my career at NPR, I've been there for 19 years, actually, I was a news reporter. And I spent about 6 years overseas as a foreign correspondent for NPR and for CNN. I covered lots of things, including four wars. I covered the wars in the former Yugoslavia. I covered Afghanistan. This is me there in 2002. I spent 4 years in and out of Iraq. This was at a time when the insurgency was gaining a lot of steam, so I spent a lot of time in Iraq. And I covered the Israel-Palestine conflict for CNN. Now, over those 6.5 years, I saw some pretty incredible depravity and desperation. And believe it or not, more often than you would think, some incredible generosity and even gallows humor in those very same places. But what happened to me during that time, and in later years, when I became a host on All Things Considered, was this nagging feeling that, this sense that something wasn't quite right. That somehow, despite all of the stories we journalists do about these conflicts, they weren't getting resolved. In fact, in many cases, they were getting worse. And what struck me about the conflicts I covered, whether it was fighting between Sunni and Shia, or Serb and Kosovar, or Israeli and Palestinian, or Hindu and Muslim, or even Republican and Democrat in this country, You know, what always struck me was how similar the enemies are. The food they eat, the languages they speak, the things they do, the way they value family and community. But because people focus so much on the small differences, like tribe and race and politics and religion and borders, they forget about the things that bind them together. And so after 15 years of being in hard news, I decided that I wanted to create a show that attempts to think about those things, you know, to remind us of what it is that makes us human and what makes our species interesting and unique and connected. So it's a show about us. We are, all of us in this room, are basically an advanced hominin species, the only species of our kind on Earth. Now, this is totally unprecedented. I mean, think about the fact that as recently as 12,000 years ago, we shared the planet with another hominin species. And we know of at least 14, actually now 15, other hominins that once roamed the Earth. And we know this because almost every single person on Earth, everybody in this room, has some Denisovan or Neanderthal or both DNA in their systems. I mean, you think about our planet, it's 4.3 billion years old. We've only been around in this exact form for 220,000 years. It's only been about 35 or 40,000 years since we left East Africa. It's only been about 10,000 years since we became an agrarian species. I mean, if you think about it, in just 0.1% of our entire history as a species, we have created the printing press, the Renaissance, Baroque music, the Enlightenment, constitutional democracy, electricity, mass transit, jet travel, space travel, the internet and mobile communication, and soon a data revolution that will change everything about the way we live our lives. It's pretty incredible, and just a blip of time. And that's sort of what I'm interested in now. That's what our show is about. It's about what connects us as humans. And the thing is, we all experience the same things. We all experience grief and death and birth and joy and love and pain. We have the capacity to be creative and compassionate, to imagine the future and the past, to be generous, to be violent. We're all affected by illness and loss at some point in our lives. We all feel hope and a sense of curiosity. These are qualities that we alone contain. And so it doesn't matter if you live in, you know, in a rural village in Africa or India or in a high-rise building in Seattle or New York. Every single one of us experiences all of these things. And so our show, very consciously, is not about the news. It's not about Americans or Europeans or Africans or Alaskans. It's just about something bigger. It's about ideas that animate us. And the idea in the show is the main character. And so what we do is we construct a narrative arc around that idea. And we design these episodes in a very intentional way. We want them to be optimistic. We want them to be inspiring. We want you to leave that hour with a sense of possibility and never feeling powerless. And so the way we begin each show, it's a very deliberate process. We start it by trying to hook you in within the first 30 seconds. And I want to just play you a brief example of how we did that in a show that I think aired about 2 years ago. It's called Champions. And the show will start and you'll hear something like this. So this in this episode, we were asking the question, how what is it that motivates some people to do these seemingly impossible things? And then do we all have this ability, you know, some force within us to persevere?
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
I'm really intrigued by this story from when you were, I don't know, 4 or 5, and your dad told you about your name, about Nayad.
Yeah.
This is Diana Nayad, the long-distance swimmer.
My dad was a Greek-Egyptian. He spoke in a very thick accent. He was dramatic. He was theatrical. He was emotional. And the day I turned 5, calls me in. We had a little den. And he said, come here, darling. Today, you are 5 years old, and I have been waiting for this day. Because today, darling, I am going to tell you the most significant thing I will ever tell you. Look in the dictionary. Naiad. In Greek mythology, The Naya swam in the lake, river, fountain, and ocean to protect for the gods, all right? Now, look in my eyes. Next definition, Naiad. Girl or woman, champion, swimmer.
So, it's an amazing story, because Diana Naiad is the only person.
Oh my God, darling. Your ever. Destiny is written in black and white. So, the word, I became a
so
swimmer.
So, she's the only person ever to, enough, you remember she swam from Cuba to but Florida, you know, without any, you know, without a cage, just in open water. So it's just, you know, these little sort of moments that we try to create at the beginning of the show. Sometimes they move very quickly. Sometimes we just did an episode called, you know, who are we? What is it that makes us us? And and the first guest in that show was a genetic researcher. And we began by talking about this giant, imagine a giant dictionary, like the biggest dictionary you've ever seen in your life. And in this dictionary, you've got just four letters, and then you hear me go back and forth with him, and he says A, G, C, and T. And then I say four letters. He says four letters. I say 3.2 billion. He says 3.2 billion. That's what makes up a human. And it's just a really cool idea that you imagine this giant book, and that's the code of your individual life. So we use a mix of, you know, experiential narrative and then social and physical science, and we try to hear from a diverse group of people. So we did a show a couple weeks ago on adaptation, where we had a comedian with cerebral palsy, a sculptor, we had an environmental scientist, we had a psychologist, and I've been able to, it's just been so incredible to interview some of these amazing, amazing people. It's just a few of them that you've heard on the show, like Sheryl Sandberg and Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. I know some of you have read his books, including Thinking Fast and Slow. Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web. Bill Gates, of course. And you know what I've learned from every single one of them is that they all have a growth mindset, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And some of you are familiar with this term from the social psychologist Carol Dweck. And basically, you know, none of these people or any of the people who are on the show really believe they have innate gifts necessarily, but they tend to see the world in a way that sees possibility, even after many failures, even after confronting great doubt and ridicule. They have made a choice to believe in possibilities. And, you know, this incredible capacity we have around us to do amazing things. You know, a lot of people ask me to sort of name the most profound interview I have had or the thing that I've learned from the show. And it's a really hard question to answer because we have interviewed for the TED Radio Hour now about 500 amazing people over the course of 3 years. So what I thought I would do today was to name just a few of them, just a couple of things, pieces of wisdom that they have shared with me and with all of you through the TED Radio Hour. So here's the first one. This is, I think, arguably the most important one, which is happiness, right? It's the one thing that all of us want more than anything else. It's happiness. And the thing is that happiness, I have learned, is really hard work. And you all know that the happiness industry is worth billions of dollars. Books and seminars and gurus, therapy, pills, meditation, fitness, faith. The happiness industry is big. And, you know, for many of us, it seems elusive sometimes. You know, why is it so hard to be happy? And the answer that I've received is that it's hard. The pursuit of happiness is like any other practice, whether it's honing a skill or working at becoming a faster runner, you never just land there. Most of the social science research supports this idea that happiness is a disciplined practice. Some of you may have heard of this man. This is a great psychologist named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. He's probably one of the most influential living thinkers on this idea of flow. He coined this term, flow. Flow is this experience of fully losing yourself, immersing yourself in an activity. And there's a direct connection between that experience and happiness. And, you know, he spent his entire life studying thousands of happy people, from very prominent scientists and musicians to artists and chief executives to assembly line workers in Detroit to Nepalese Sherpas to garbage men. And he found that in the cases of people who were happy, it didn't really matter what they did. If they found a way to experience flow in their lives, they seemed to be truly happy. And he found that what often differentiated people who were able to live a mainly happy life wasn't that they were necessarily without challenges. He actually found a lot of happiness in people who were terminally ill or who had chronic illness. What generally differentiated them, he found, was framing, basically. The way they saw their own situations, the story and the narrative that they told themselves about themselves. So this is one of the quotes from the show. I won't read it for you, but I will leave it up there, which I love. I love this idea. And he really lives this idea. There's an incredibly gifted psychologist from Harvard named Robert Waldinger who was on our show recently. We did a show about wisdom. And he researched thousands of people from different backgrounds to find out what it was that made them happy. Other psychologists have looked at Tibetan monks to find out what makes them so joyful. And the two things that researchers have come up with, the two things that social science can definitively correlate with happiness are these two secrets. I'm going to let you in on these secrets. The first one is relationships, maintaining relationships with people around you. Now, it doesn't have to be a lot of relationships, but just a few meaningful ones. It's crucial. And the second one, and this is really, really interesting, and this is where hard work comes in sometimes, is gratitude. If you remind yourself as many times as you can throughout the day about the things you have, you know, your health and your family, your friends, access to amazing salmon, Alaska Public Radio, being born in a free country, whatever it is, everyone in this room has reasons to be grateful. There are things that you can be grateful about. And we know that through research that thinking grateful thoughts releases dopamine and cortisol. I mean, it actually has a physical impact, and it changes the way you start to think about the world. And it's not always easy, especially on a really crappy day, right? Like, you're thinking, oh, this day is horrible. Okay, gratitude. And sometimes I find myself in those positions. I'm, like, biking home from work, and I'm like, okay, gratitude, please, more gratitude. And, it's not a panacea. It's not it doesn't always work instantly. But I think it's really important and significant finding. And so, this stuff takes practice. For most of us, happiness doesn't just happen. Something that I've learned from the people who've been on the show. Which leads me to another really big idea that has stayed with me, and that is that we humans are a work in progress. So we all think, most of us think that the person we are now is the culmination of all of our experiences. Like, we've arrived to this point, I am who I am now, and this is who I will always be. And science disproves this. Dan Gilbert, who many of you have heard of and maybe have heard on the show, he has shown that not only do we change dramatically over the course of our lives, but that we have the capacity to change things about ourselves as well. So he says, the person you are right now is as transient, as fleeting, as temporary as all the people you've ever been. The one constant in your life is change. Now, the amazing thing about us is that we can do this, right? Steven Pinker is somebody, another amazing researcher who's been on the show a few times. He's argued that a big part of who we are is just kind of hardwired. That, so for example, I am a pretty obsessive person, and I can obsess with details. And it drives people crazy. It drives my wife crazy. It drives everyone around me crazy. But it's sort of more or less who I am. It's written in my genetic code. Our understanding of the human genome is now becoming so sophisticated that recently a company in the Silicon Valley claimed to have identified the particular gene that can determine whether you are a morning person, which is pretty amazing.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host and editor of the TED Radio Hour, and this is KSKA Anchorage. Celebrate being informed, involved, and connected to fellow Alaskans and the world, one story at a time, through public media. Take a moment to share these experiences with all Alaskans by choosing to support Alaska Public Media today, right now. Go online at alaskapublic.org or call 550-8484. to show your support and celebrate public media for all.
Now, here is the rub with all this, okay? Despite all of these things that are written into our genetic code, our individual genetic code, those 3.2 billion letters of A, G's, C's, and T's, we have a lot of control over our behavior, of course. It's why we can change, and it's why, unlike any other species, we can improve if we want to. So let me give you an example. I'm sure a lot of you grew up thinking, I'm not a math person. Did anybody grow up thinking, I'm not a math person? Does anybody think I'm not a math person? Right? So I mentioned Carol Dweck, who's another amazing social scientist. And she mainly studies children. This is Carol. And several years ago, she went to a school in Chicago. And this is a school where students were performing really poorly. And she started to observe how, you know, students reacted to receiving an F grade on their papers. And they would basically tell themselves, I'm just not any good at math or whatever it was, or reading or English, and they would mostly give up. So she inserted a bit of social engineering into this classroom. And what she told the teachers was, instead of giving them an F on your papers, write three simple words at the top of papers and exams that are failures. Write these words: not there yet. Now, this might not sound that remarkable, but what is remarkable is what happened next. Because by reframing the feedback, by using the word yet, it triggered a sense of possibility in those kids. Something that could be improved. And not there yet meant that at some point they would get there. And over the course of a year, those students saw a measurable increase in their test scores and learning outcomes. And it's a project and an approach that's been replicated in different ways across the country, including in Seattle, outside of Seattle. And so this is what Carol Dweck calls the growth mindset. Most of us are trapped in what's called a fixed mindset. You know, we were raised to think that, you know, people told us that we have limitations. I'm not smart, I'm not good at math, I can't tell stories, whatever it is. But the growth mindset says, when I challenge myself and push myself out of my comfort zone, my mind grows, and it allows me to discover capacities and capabilities I didn't know I had. Because none of us, what Carol argues, none of us really knows our potential. We have no ability to know how much our minds can expand. And the simple truth is, and she's convinced me, is that the growth mindset is a fact. It is a fact. And the fixed mindset is fiction. It's something many of us have fallen for. I mean, we are the most nimble and versatile and adaptive species that ever walked the planet. It means that no one is not good at math or not good at learning. It means we all have these different paths for figuring out how to get better at those things. So it leads me to the third big idea that I have taken from the show. And it's tied in some ways to the first lesson on happiness. And I love this one. It's reality. You know, the reality we experience isn't necessarily what is real. So it's why two people can have the same exact experience and walk away with completely different perspectives on what happened, right? And I'm sure many of you here have gone on vacation with a spouse or a partner, and you had very different experiences, or you went to a party, and one of you hated it and one of you loved it. Memory and perception are subjective. So this is Danny Kahneman. He put this idea forward. He's probably, you know, one of the most influential psychologists in the world, and he really is kind of one of the fathers of behavioral economics. And when I interviewed Kahneman about this theory, he explained how we humans perceive happiness based on what he calls our experiencing selves and our remembering selves. So this is an example he gives, which is there's a man that went to a symphony, and he heard this world-class orchestra performed this piece of magisterial beauty. And at the end of the 20-minute piece, he heard an awful screech. There was a noise in the crowd. There was a chair that moved. And immediately after the concert, he said, "How was it?" And the man said, "It was terrible. The screech ruined the entire experience for me," which is how he remembered that experience. And so what Kahneman realized was that something else was happening. It didn't it didn't actually ruin the experience. It ruined the memory of his experience, right? And that memory is how our minds evaluate the world around us. It's our remembering selves more than our experiencing selves that often shapes our perceptions. And, you know, in fact, positive associations and memories are often formed in our brains in the middle of an experience. And so what Kahneman found is that no matter how great the experience, if it ends badly, even if just for a moment, it can color the entire memory of the experience. And here's what's remarkable about Danny Kahneman. He actually internalizes this research. And so when I interviewed him, I knew that he had been in Geneva, and I saw that the booking had changed to a few days earlier. And so when he got to the studio, I said, hey, that's odd. I thought we were supposed to have our interview in 3 days from now. Did anything go wrong in Geneva? And he said, oh, no, it was actually an incredible trip, the highlight of my year. But because it was going so well, my wife and I just decided to leave 3 or 4 days early. It was incredible. He leaves parties early when he's having a great time. He just, you know, thanks for everything, he leaves. And I'm like the experimenter. Like, I try these things on myself. You know, my team jokes that I go through so many diets, I'm like a teenage girl. Like, I've done vegan, paleo, and this and that. Anyway, I've tried this, and it actually works. I now leave parties when everything's going great. And I turn to my wife, I say, this is great. And she's like, it's 8 o'clock. And I'm saying, yeah, but it's great. It's really fun. Let's go home. So think about that the next time you're at a party, you know, or at this in the middle of the speech, if you feel like, you know what, that was great, I'm out of here. All right, let me leave you with one more big idea that I've learned about being human, and that is creativity and failure are two sides of the same coin. So I've interviewed incredibly prolific artists and writers and entrepreneurs, from Sting to Taylor Swift to Eminem to Richard Branson. And the one thing that creative people have in common is a willingness to fail. Now, it doesn't mean that they like it. In fact, most of us don't like to fail, right? But without failure, or at least without the willingness to screw up, the capacity to create and grow will be stunted. So there's a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins. His name is Charles Lim. And he wanted to identify the source of creativity in the brain. He wanted to see if he could figure this out. And he had a hard time identifying the right people to do this with, but he decided to settle on jazz musicians, great jazz musicians. And what he did was and the reason why he wanted to do this is because in free-form jazz, you know, the kind of music you would hear from like Keith Jarrett or Miles Davis, it's all about improvisation. And to get to that place, you have to be willing to mess it up. You can't create magic like Keith Jarrett does if your baseline is always succeeding. So Charles Lim gathered these incredible musicians and he hooked them up to fMRI, which is a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, and he had them play music following notes. And he didn't see a whole lot of activity happening in their brains. And then he had them play freeform. And of course, their brains were lighting up, you know, because they were inventing and creating as they played. Now, the music they were playing was not as pitch perfect, and it, in some ways, wasn't as good at them in the moment. There were moments of just brilliance, but he found on his, you know, when he was analyzing the fMRI, he was just watching this incredible activity happening. So, you know, The point of all this is that creativity isn't like this mysterious thing that only some people have. It's just that creative people are willing to fail and to make mistakes and follow their curiosity and keep pushing it forward. So that's what I do. Like you, as an upright, advanced hominin species, I feel an incredible privilege to get to help spread these ideas around the world. And if you haven't noticed, I've drank the Kool-Aid. I'm like a total, you know, some people call TED a cult. Fine, it's cult. You know, I'm sure some of you also have drunk the Kool-Aid. Um, and I hope you can hear on the radio that it is genuinely joyful and fun. We love producing this show. It's an incredible, just an incredible experience to work with an amazing team of people who genuinely love to produce great radio and to put out an optimistic and hopeful and joyful program. And the thing is, you know, we can only really do this on public radio. I mean, could you imagine CNN or Fox News or any, like, network television station saying, hey, let's hand over an hour of our airtime to a show about what it means to be human? I mean, where would the shouting and the bickering go? Where would the ad dollars go? Like, they would just dry up. And it's funny because I have a lot of friends. I live in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. has a lot of lawyers and lobbyists and politicians and journalists. So I know some of those journalists who work in commercial media, and if, you know, they really wish that they could do what we do on public radio. And really this sort of the secret sauce to all of this is the people. And I'm not just talking about the people on the air or the people in Washington, but the people all around us and the community, like all of you who are here. Earlier I talked about when I was at CNN, and you know, it's funny, when I started out in radio, because I didn't grow up in an NPR household. My parents didn't listen to it. I wasn't one of those kids strapped to, to a car seat. Actually, there were no car seats when I was a kid. We would lie down on the back of the station wagon on long road trips when that was legal. But I didn't grow up in a house. So when I came to NPR, my parents would ask me, how's the radio station? And for many years, they would say, when are you going to go into television? You know, they'd say, when are you going to be on television? Then I got to television, and then my parents would call me and say, you know, none of our friends, they're all asking, where are you gone? Where are you gone? Because they don't hear you on NPR anymore. So when I went to CNN, and this is the truth, you know, a lot of people thought I'd left journalism because there's a different connection that listeners and viewers have with television news and with public radio news. And the biggest reason why is because you own us, right? You are our boss, not Comcast or GE or a corporation. We rely on you, you know? And so public radio belongs to all of us, so everybody here feels like they have a stake in it. I mean, I get letters from, just last night I was at an event and people were saying, why don't you do this, this, or that? And I'm saying, all right, let me take some notes. You know, what's going on here? That's the amazing thing about public radio, is that it's a community of people who really feel like, you know, they have a voice, because they do. And the people who work in public radio, it's really important for you to understand that when we walk through the doors of our institutions, whether it's at NPR in Washington, D.C., or here in Anchorage, at Alaska Public Media, or in the remote places like, you know, Bethel or, you know, Nome or Sitka, where there are reporters. The people who do this believe in the mission. We believe that we are stewards of this incredible institution. I've been at NPR for 19 years. When I got there, I was already, you know, 25 years old. I'm here. I'll be there for, you know, my career, and then I'll leave, and then other people will be stewards of this incredible institution. And I believe that these institutions, Alaska Public Media, NPR, every other public media organization you listen to, are essential institutions. And I suspect you would agree with me on that. I mean, we really believe that when people are informed, democracies function better. When people are exposed to different ideas, our interactions are better. When we hear stories that move us, we have more empathy. And, you know, frankly, nobody else in the news business interviews penguins as well as we do. I mean, CNN has never done that. Shocking. And this network here in Alaska, this network of stations, really is a treasure, a state treasure, and a national treasure. I mean, transmitters and stations in every pocket of this state, which is just incredible. You know, I was saying this earlier to the team here in Anchorage, that it's a little bit like the University of Kentucky basketball team, you know, that team that produces all these amazing NBA stars. I mean, you think about Alaska Public Media, you've had Corey Flintoff and Peter Kenyon, Elizabeth Arnold, Tom Goldman worked here. I mean, some amazing people, legends in public radio have worked here. I mean, this network has had an incredibly huge impact on our national conversation. Now, I don't normally do this. I don't normally make pitches for money, and I don't come to these things to shake trees. I'm not going to really do that now. I'm going to do it a little bit. But I'm going to just say this. What we do costs money. You know, in the United Kingdom, I was the bureau chief for NPR in London for 2 years. In the United Kingdom, every household that owns a television or radio has to pay a compulsory license fee, right? That means that the BBC has an annual operating budget of $5 billion, okay? That's in a country of just 60 million people, right? It's the same in Japan. It's the same in most European countries. There's a compulsory license fee or a tax. NPR's entire operating budget is equivalent to 4.3% of the BBC's budget, right? We do that for 300 million people. Now, think about this. With that budget, we have more foreign bureaus, more domestic bureaus than almost any other news organization in the United States. While every other news organization has been retrenching, we've been expanding. We've built more bureaus around the world in the last 10 years as other institutions have shrunk. You know, when I came to Berlin as a correspondent for NPR in 2000, you know, if you were an aspiring foreign correspondent, you would go work for any number of newspapers. In fact, in Berlin in 2000, NPR had a bureau, and CNN had a bureau, and the New York Times had a bureau, but so did the Boston Globe, and the Chicago Tribune, and the Dallas Morning News, and the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, and the Miami Herald, and the LA Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle. And guess what? Today, there are two organizations that have a bureau there, NPR and the New York Times. When I was there, the Foreign Press Association was full of American journalists. None of those news organizations have bureaus anymore outside the US. And most of them don't even have bureaus in Washington, DC anymore. I mean, it's a completely different environment. And in some ways, we're the last man standing. So what, or we're the last organization standing. I don't like that expression. Sorry about that. Scratch that. So with that money, we really think about how to use that money wisely. I mean, we are the only, and most of that money comes from you. I mean, the vast majority of our budget comes from voluntary contributions. I told the story last night, I remember when I was in London, I had a friend who worked for the BBC, and when we first met, he said, oh, NPR, that impoverished American radio station that always begs for money, right? I said, yes, that's us. And he was amazed to find out that in the United States, about 12% of public radio listeners voluntarily contribute. It's an incredible rate. I mean, if you were to say to people in the UK or in Germany, hey, this is voluntary now, you don't have to contribute to the BBC, you probably get a 1% or 2% compliance rate. I mean, people really, like, public radio really sits on the shoulders of the people who listen to it. So it's so important. Your contributions are so important. It's we couldn't do the TED Radio Hour without it. We couldn't do Invisibilia. We couldn't do Hidden Brain and other programs that you hear, not, you know, let alone Morning Edition or All Things Considered. These are programs that I hope you find essential and meaningful in your lives. And so when you think about the things that are meaningful in your lives, like maybe, you know, you contribute to a church or a synagogue or an alma mater or an animal rescue clinic or a charity for chronic illnesses, I hope that you also consider public radio as an essential part of your life and you think about that. Because those contributions support the work we do every single day. And I really hope that when you hear the TED Radio Hour or Morning Edition or All Things Considered, or Alaska Public Media, you hear that. You really hear that coming through the radio. So thank you for your support. Thank you for coming here to see me. I just can't believe that people will pay money to come see me speak on a stage. It's still amazing to me every time I speak. This has been an incredible experience for the last few days here. We have a few more days of exploring in Alaska, and I'm really excited. Sadly, we have to go back Sunday because school starts on Monday. But we will be back, and my wife and I are already planning our trip. We're already, like, eyeing, you know, the roads, although the roads end at a certain point in Alaska. Like, you can't go any further. So we're already eyeing them, and I will be back. And thank you for your warm welcome here. And I'd love to take your questions. So thank you.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host and editor of the TED Radio Hour. Join the team. Become a member. Be a part of the programming that you trust and depend on. Become a member today, right now, at alaskapublic.org or call 550-8484.
There we go. Yes. So, any questions about NPR, about the TED Radio Hour, about the news, about my Little League career? I think there's a microphone somewhere around here, and I think the microphones are there. Okay, so there's a microphone because this is being recorded for posterity, actually. But maybe you will be part of the posterity. You know, we'll sort of use your voice as a way to get the word out on Alaska Public Media. Yes.
Hello, Guy.
Hi.
My name is Lynn, and I'm actually leaving Alaska in about 5 weeks to go to Florida to be with my 90-year-old dad. My husband died recently. But, you know, one of the things that I said during his memorial is that I'm a dreamer. I am a dreamer and I'm an idealist. I have been all my life. And I think that I've always been interested in exploring topics that you talk about, and I really appreciate your show. And many people have said that I should be on TED Radio because I have talked about disability oppression and attitudinal barriers all my life. And so hopefully maybe I'll be on TED someday. But I really appreciate your show, your enthusiasm, and your optimism. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, it's amazing. It's really amazing is when I was a news reporter and I traveled around the world and I covered these conflicts, most of the feedback you get when you cover conflicts is negative feedback because people are angry about the stories. They don't, you know, even if you're trying to illuminate hardship on both sides of a conflict and you're trying to be fair, you really are, people get angry because they don't want to hear it. And if it's not their story or their narrative or the way they see it, understandably, they get angry. What's remarkable about the TED Radio Hour is we receive almost universally positive feedback. Now, and I'm not saying that's necessarily, you know, I mean, sometimes you want negative feedback too, but what's really amazing is how many people around the world listen to the show, and you would be stunned at how many people tweet at us from, you know, from countries that you wouldn't even imagine, like Iran and Yemen and Syria. I received an email from a listener in Syria, in Aleppo, who wrote to me and he said, "Thank you for your recent show on death. I live in Aleppo where we see a lot of it. Your show really helped me get through my day." I wrote him back and I said, "Wow, I can't believe that you have taken the time to not only listen to the show, but to write to us. Thank you. This is so meaningful to me." And he wrote back and he said, "I have an internet connection and I listen every week. And that show really, really stuck with me. It was a really important show." And that show that we did on death, we had, you know, of course it was a hard show to do, but there were moments of levity as well. You know, we had an amazing young visual artist who's also a scientist who wants everybody to be buried in a mushroom suit because she thinks we should all come back, you know, should all like decompose back into the earth and then a beautiful garden will grow out of us. And it's just a cool idea. You know, she actually got on the TED stage wearing a mushroom suit. And I thought, how cool is that? And I, you know, I mean, I'm really thinking about ordering a mushroom suit because it's just really cool. So thank you for that. It really means a lot to hear that. Yes.
So I'm Meredith Noble. The question I'm about to ask you, I've asked leaders, mentors, strangers on the bus. So here it goes. What do you wish you knew in your mid-20s?
I wish I knew in my mid-20s that... Well, here's what happens. We have created a, more or less in sort of, you know, middle class America, and for young people who go to college, right, which is about a third of young people now in America, maybe a little bit more than that, we've created this kind of system where you go through elementary school and then middle school and high school, and more or less you are supported. You have a safety net, and everyone's saying, cheering you on, and you're working hard, and then you go to college, and everyone's cheering you on, and you are in university, and you find some success. Maybe you write a really great essay. Maybe a professor recognizes you. Maybe you work on a student activity. You organize a concert, an event. You are recognized for what you do in college, and then you leave, and everyone says, right on, now go out there into the world, and the safety net's gone. And you're 22 or 23 or 24. And we don't prepare people for that. And so you have this perfect storm of that experience, and also an increasing understanding and awareness that the human brain continues to develop until age 29, that our prefrontal cortex isn't fully, completely developed until around the age of 28, 29. So you have this uncertainty hovering over you with all of these like things happening in your head. And so a lot of young people, and this happened to me, experience a lot of anxiety, uncertainty, depression, at a time when, you know, people, most older people say, what's your problem? You're in your mid-20s, you know, live it up. Things are great. But the reality is it's a very difficult time in life. And I wish I knew, there are two things I wish I knew. I wish I knew that that when I was experiencing those things, they were very real, that it wasn't my fault. And the other thing I wish I knew was that there's value in making yourself vulnerable, that there's value in talking about what's going on with you to other people, because oftentimes they're also experiencing those things. And I talk a lot about this with younger people at NPR who have just come there. You know, we get these amazing interns from all over the country, and, you know, all of a sudden they're just an intern, or that's just the way they're seen in the hallways. And they have to start building their lives up, and they have to start building up to some recognition, or to, you know, the ability to get some kind of, for somebody to have confidence in them, and to give them an opportunity. And I find over and over again that experience is really common. And so for me, I wish I knew that, because I was very anxious, and I was at NPR. I came to NPR when I was 22, but I was like a, you know, just a ball of nerves inside. And it took time for that to ease up. I mean, some of that is just time and just getting older and having a family and whatever it is, finding a partner that, for me, changed those things. And but I wish, I, you know, of course you wish you had a crystal ball, right? But that's a really important thing. I think it's really important to remember that it is a very difficult time in life. So
you're telling me the anxiety I've experienced asking this question will go away in a few years?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I didn't want to let you escape without trying to answer a question on the presidential election.
Okay. I'll do my best.
And my question goes to how does NPR stay neutral and during the face of extreme polarization within the news organizations?
Yeah, it's a great question. We were talking a little bit about this with a team at Alaska Public Media the other day. We all had, it was a really good conversation about, you know, how do you cover this election? This is the, you know, this is a very complicated election to cover. In my case, so I do the TED Radio Hour, but I have a few side projects, and one of my main side projects is I do a children's news show every Friday on satellite radio. It's called the Breakfast Blast Newscast. And if you have a child between the ages of 4 and 10, it's pretty cool. It's really fun. And it's challenging to talk about this election on that show because, you know, I won't let my children watch much of it. I mean, some of the debates, just the language that was used and the innuendo, I just wouldn't want to expose my kids to that. Some of the rhetoric to me is... it's negative, and I want them to still sort of, while I can sort of preserve it, to have a positive view of the world and of what's out there and the amazing things that are available to them. I think that NPR has done a very good job. It's very hard because some people say, well, you know, the news media has a responsibility to see this election as an anomaly. This is different. This is not too mainstream political candidates who fit into a broad mainstream, you know, whether it was Mitt Romney or Barack Obama or John McCain and Obama or, you know, Al Gore and George W. Bush, there was a more or less a consensus, right? They'd more or less agreed on a stable world order and economic stability and trade, and then there were other differences. And so some people say, you know, the media has a responsibility to say this is different and we shouldn't be normalizing Donald Trump because he's not a normal candidate, okay? And I think it's a big challenge for people, because what do you do when somebody says, you know, Second Amendment people, you know, you can speak up on this? I mean, what does that mean? Is that a threat? Or, you know, when you know, it's just been unprecedented when a sitting judge is accused of bias because of his background. A candidate threatens to pull out of NATO. I mean, forget about whether you agree or disagree with them. None of these things have ever been said or spoken. So it's a real challenge for the news media to figure out how do you approach this. Here's what I would say. I think NPR has done a really good job at trying to understand and amplify the voices of people who feel disenfranchised and who feel like they've been ignored. You know, a huge swath of people in this country are underemployed, or they feel threatened because of changes happening in this country. And whether you agree or disagree with those views, you know, there's no question that there is anxiety. And so, you know, this is going to sound very TED Radio Hour and probably a little bit, I don't know, naive, but I try to approach every interview I do with empathy. I mean, I'm not a news reporter anymore. I don't do news. And even when I did news, I tried to be empathetic as often as I could, as best as I could. I think it's the same with the way we should approach this election, that as much as we can be empathetic and show compassion, even at times when we're just in total personal disagreement with an issue or a question, that goes a long way. I still listen to NPR News for information, because I think it's the best and the least, you know, you turn on cable news and it's almost like they're just printing money based on the coverage of Trump, because he seems to bring ratings and numbers, and you know, they're doing gangbusters, right? The television networks are doing great this year. I think we've made a real effort to cover this election fairly and with a sort of a dispassionate voice, but also not afraid to be critical. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was awesome.
I think that's it, right? There are no more questions there. So thank you all for coming. It's really been amazing to be here. The fact that you all spent your Thursday evening here with me is an incredible honor. Thank you for listening to the show. We make it for you. I'm going to picture all of you in my mind. Remember, I'm like, I've got to finish it. I cannot fall asleep tonight. I've got to finish the script because you and you and you and you are waiting for it. So thank you for listening to the show. Thanks for supporting public radio. I'll hang out for a little while longer if anybody has any questions or wants to talk more. And good night.
The race for the White House is dominating this year's election coverage because, of course, we will have a new president. But it's not the only contest you're focused on. Alaskans will elect a U.S. senator, a U.S. representative, and state legislators. And that's why KSKA-FM 91.1 is also your source for news and analysis about the races that happen right here in Alaska. We provide the coverage, and our contributing listeners make it possible. This is why your support matters so much. Right now. Go online at alaskapublic.org or call 550-8484 to show your support and celebrate public media for all.